Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka was the landmark 1954 Supreme Court case in which Supreme Court unanimously ruled that racial segregation of children in public schools was unconstitutional. Brown versus Board of Education was one of the cornerstones of the Civil Rights Movement and helped establish the precedent of separate but equal was in fact not equal at all. This is One Mic Black History. I'm your host, Country Boy. And if this is the type of content that you enjoy, you can find more content like this at onemichistory.com. Also, if you'd like to support the channel, you can do so on my Patreon page or my Buy Me Coffee in the description below. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and support the YouTube channel. But without further ado, let's get started. Although the Declaration of Independence states that all men were created equal, the statement was not actually law in the United States until after the Civil War. It wasn't until the 13th in 1865, the 14th in 1868, and the 15th Amendment in 1870 that ended slavery, gave equal protections under the law, and gave African-American men the right to vote that the federal government even attempted to make men actually equal. Still, African Americans were often treated very differently from whites, especially in the South. Many state legislatures began to enact laws that mandated the segregation of races. As I spoke to in previous episodes, these laws became known as Jim Crow laws. It was not until 1890 that these laws were directly challenged in the court. In 1892, an African American man by the name of Homer Plessy refused to give his seat to a white man on a train in New Orleans, which he was required to do under the separate car law that was passed by the Louisiana legislature in 1890. Because of his actions, he was arrested. Plessy then contended that the Louisiana law separating blacks from whites on trains violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. By 1896, the case had made its way all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. By a vote of 7-1, the Supreme Court ruled against Plessy, ruling that racially segregated public facilities were legal so long as the facilities for black people and white people were made equal. Justice Henry Billings would state that the objection of the 14th Amendment is undoubtful to enforce the equality of two races before the law. In the nature of things, it could not have been intended to abolish the distinction based on color or to endorse social as distinguished from political equality. If one race is inferior to the other socially, the Constitution of the United States cannot put them on the same plane. Basically, the 14th Amendment only applied to political and civil rights, but not social rights. The ruling created sanctioned laws barring African Americans from sharing the same buses, schools, and other public facilities as whites, and establishing separate but equal as a doctrine in the United States. As a result of the Plessy decision, early in the 20th century, the Supreme Court continued to uphold the legality of Jim Crow laws and other forms of racial distinction. For instance, in 1899, in the case of Cummings versus Richmond Board of Education, the Supreme Court refused to issue an injunction preventing the school board from spending tax money on a white school when the same school board had closed a black school for financial reasons. Also in 1926, in Gollum v. Rice, the court upheld the school's decision to bar a student of Chinese descent from a white school. Despite the Supreme Court ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson and similar cases since, organizations like the NAACP continued to press for the end of Jim Crow. Beginning in the 1930s, the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund began to try to make progress in overturning segregation in the courts. From 1935 to 1938, the legal arm of the NAACP devised a strategy to attack Jim Crow laws by striking them in the field of education where they perceived them to be the weakest. In 1933, the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund decided to take on the case of Donald Murray, an applicant to the University of Maryland's Law School who was rejected solely because of his race. The NAACP decided to challenge its practice in the Maryland court system. So before a Baltimore City court in 1935, NAACP lawyers argued that Donald Gaines Murray was just as qualified as any white applicant and that solely based on his race that he was rejected. Furthermore, they argued that since black law schools in which Murray could attend were nowhere near the academic caliber of the University of Maryland Law School, the disparities between white and black law schools were so great that the only remedy was to allow him to attend the University of Maryland. The Baltimore City Court agreed, and the University of Maryland appealed to the Maryland Court of Appeals, but in 1936, the Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Murray and ordered the law school to admit him. In 1936, Lloyd Gaines, a graduate of Lincoln University, applied to the University of Missouri Law School, but was denied solely based on his race. The state of Missouri gave Gaines two options: to either attend an all-black law school that had not been built yet in Missouri because Missouri did not have any all-black law schools at the time, or have Missouri help pay for him to attend a law school in a neighboring state. Gaines rejected both of these options and employed the services of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. He decided to sue the state in order to allow him to attend the University of Missouri's law school. In 1938, his case reached the Supreme Court, and in December of that year, the court ruled with Gaines. Unlike the Murray case, which only had an impact in Maryland, the Supreme Court ruling in the Missouri case would be felt nationwide. The six-member majority ruled, since the black law school did not currently exist in the state of Missouri, the Equal Protection Clause required the state to provide, within its boundaries, a legal education for Gaines. In other words, since the state did not provide a legal education for white students, it could not send black students like Gaines to another state. Unfortunately, one night in 1939, Gaines left home to buy stamps and was never seen again. In 1940, the case was dismissed due to the lack of the plaintiff. During the 1950s, the NAACP felt that the time was right for a more aggressive approach. The Legal Defense Fund, the National Legal Committee, and 14 branch leaders of the NAACP came up with a plan to end racial segregation once and for all. This inaugurated a new era of NAACP litigation. There would be no more tiptoeing around Plessy versus Ferguson. The time had come to topple it completely, and it was an exceedingly ambitious goal given the state of race relations in the United States. The NAACP then encouraged African-American parents to enroll their children in white school. All the parents' requests were refused, including that of Oliver Brown, the plaintiff in the case of Brown versus the Board of Education. The case originated in 1951 when the public school of Topeka, Kansas refused to enroll the daughter of a local black resident, Oliver Brown, at the school closest to her home, requiring her to travel on a bus to a segregated elementary school further away. Unlike school districts in other states, in Topeka, the lower courts ruled that while requiring certain changes, they had found that the segregated school was substantially equal with respect to buildings, transportation, curricula, and educational qualifications of the teachers. Hence, the involvement of the Kansas case in the Supreme Court's findings would hinge solely on the matter of segregation. The Browns and 12 other local families in similar situations, with the help of the NAACP, filed a class action lawsuit in the U.S. federal court system against Topeka Board of Education, alleging that the segregation policy was unconstitutional. Then Brown's case and four other cases, Briggs v. Elliott, Davis v. Board of Education of Prince Edwards County, Bowling v. Sharp, and Gerhardt v. Ethel. While the facts in all these cases were different, all the cases were related to school segregation and first became for the Supreme Court in 1952. The court then combined all these cases under the name Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka. Once again, the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund handled the cases, and an attorney for the plaintiff was Thurgood Marshall. On December 9, 1952, Brown versus the Board of Education was argued before the Supreme Court. Marshall stated that black students in Topeka who had attended segregated schools, even though the facilities were equal, were being denied equal educational opportunities. He would state that the Constitution did not stop with the fact that you have equal facilities and covers the entire educational process. Paul E. Wilson, the Assistant Attorney General for Kansas, based his defense on the 1896 Plessy decision. It is our theory that the case resolves itself to this: whether separate but equal doctrine is still the law. Wilson's argument put the issue squarely on the Supreme Court. The state of Kansas, he argued, was happy to do whatever the court decided, but the court had never ruled on the Plessy decision. Over the next 2 days, Briggs v. Elliott, Davis v. Board of Education of Prince Edwards County, Bowling v. Sharp, and Gerhardt v. Ethel were all argued before the Supreme Court with similar arguments. At first, the justices were deeply divided. Most of them wanted to reverse Plessy and declare segregation in public schools to be unconstitutional. But Chief Justice Fred M. Benison held, in his opinion, that the Plessy verdict should stand. Unable to come to a solution, then June 8, 1953, the Supreme Court shocked the NAACP and the nation by deciding to rehear the case. The court issued 5 questions to the lawyers on either side of the case. The questions were mostly historical and designed to address whether the framers of the 14th Amendment would understood it to be inconsistent with the racial segregation of public education. More importantly, it was a delaying tactic. In the 1952 election brought a new president in office, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Some members of the court felt that Eisenhower administration needed time for whatever decision the Supreme Court gave. But in September of 1953, Chief Justice Fred M. Benison would die, and President Dwight Eisenhower would replace him with Earl Warren, then governor of California. Chief Justice Warren was able to do something that Justice Benison could not. He was able to bring all the justices to agree to support a unanimous decision against school segregation. On May 17, 1954, the United States Supreme Court ruled unanimously 9-0 that racial segregation in public schools violated the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which prohibits states from denying equal protection of laws to any person within its jurisdiction. The decision declared that separate but equal facilities for white and black students were inherently unequal, thus rejecting separate but equal doctrine in public schools. Although the 1954 decision strictly applied to public schools, it was implied that segregation was not permissible in other public facilities. While the Supreme Court ruled against separate but equal doctrine, it didn't actually explain how they would go about integrating schools. May 1955, the court would issue a second opinion in the case on how they shall proceed. It was called Brown versus the Board of Education II, which remanded future desegregation cases to lower courts and directed school districts to proceed with a deliberate speed. Although it was well-intentioned, the court's actions effectively opened the door for the invasion of desegregation. While states like Kansas and some other states acted in accordance to the verdict, many schools and local officials in the South openly defied it. One famous example was in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, in which 9 black students, known as the Little Rock Nine, enrolled in the all-white Central High School. They faced angry mobs and the threat from even the governor. It culminated in President Dwight Eisenhower having to call in military action to protect the students. This open defiance and violent confrontation of school segregation was called the Massive Resistance, and it was able to hold up integration for years. By 1960, only 34 of North Carolina's 300,000 black students attended segregated schools, and in 5 Deep South states, all of their 1.4 million black children attended segregated schools in 1960. By 1968, the Supreme Court ordered states to dismantle segregated school systems root and branch. The court identified 5 factors which would be used to gauge a school's compliance with Brown versus the Board of Education. By 1969, the Supreme Court declared that the deliberate speed standard was no longer constitutionally permissible and ordered the immediate desegregation of schools in Mississippi. Still, to this day, school integration is an ongoing process. It wasn't until 1988 that school integration reached its height, with almost 45% of black students in the United States attending majority white schools. Even today, the debate continues on how to combat racial inequalities in the nation's school system, the new debate largely based on the differences between resources in wealthier areas and economically disadvantaged areas across the nation. In the aftermath, the Supreme Court decision to turn over separate but equal doctrine didn't actually achieve school desegregation on its own, but it did set a legal precedent that would be used to overturn laws enforcing segregation in other public facilities. Additionally, the ruling advanced the budding civil rights movement in the United States. Later in 1955, a year after Brown versus the Board of Education, Rosa Parks would spark the Montgomery bus boycott, which would lead to sit-ins, demonstrations, and a movement that would eventually topple Jim Crow across the nation. Thank you. This has been One Mic Black History, and I'm your host, Country Boy. And if you like this, you can find more content like this at onemichistory.com. Also, if you like to support the channel, you can do so at my Buy Me Coffee on my Patreon page in the description below. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and support the YouTube channel. Peace.